Saturday.
What day is it today?
Wednesday.
Exactly.
Welcome to Film Fight Club. I'm Glenn Falcon, Stunt for Falcon Screen, and we are joined by freelance writer and critic Virat Nehru.
Hello, hello, people.
And Sydney filmmaker Chris Evans. Now, we've got a lot to talk about this week. We're doing our final week of MIFF coverage. MIFF has wrapped the Melbourne International Film Festival to great success. It was a wonderful festival. We're very glad to have online. We're going to be talking Sun Children and Pickpocket, and then later into the podcast, Moon 66 Questions, Stray, Les Civil, and Rock Bottom Riser. We're also going to be talking a little bit about Blue Lotus and Chapelwait, a couple of series streaming on Stan and Netflix, respectively. The other way around. Before we get into that, though, we want to talk about the big news of the week, which is Spider-Man. The Spider-Man trailer dropped. I don't care. I'm sorry. I know it's the big film news. I don't care.
I didn't watch it. My policy, which I occasionally break, but typically stick to these days, is that if there's a trailer for a film I'm sold on that's out, I won't bother to watch it, because all the trailer can do is give away some of the surprises at that point. And if it's something that I don't think I'll watch, but, you know, maybe, or like a Marvel movie where it's like close to no interest, I'll watch the trailer. But now, everyone's buzzing about this trailer, and I just couldn't even be bothered to click it. The Marvel enthusiasm has reached such a level.
Into this movie, it just took so long that everyone was like, this trailer has to exist, and the trailer is a weird event in itself.
They call it a teaser trailer, and it's 3 minutes long. I don't understand. How is it teasing anything?
Is it 3 minutes?
Yeah, well, because if it's a teaser trailer, they can release a feature trailer and a follow-up feature trailer and a feature trailer subsequent to the actual movie. But this does have elements to it. By that, I mean performers that intrigue me. I won't say more in case you don't want to watch the trailer, Chris, but that's enough for me to want to see this movie.
I think everyone's going to know about this stuff, so maybe we can discuss it. I haven't seen the trailer. I knew before the trailer what the hook of this movie is.
But the buzz about Shang-Chi seems to be pretty positive, which I'm...
A lot of people are saying it's a pretty middling Marvel movie.
I've heard that too. It looks middling, honestly. It doesn't look that good. Right. It looks rote.
Yeah,
which means it's a good Marvel film, right? A middling Marvel movie is really good because most of them are bad, right?
The thing about Spider-Man, it's such nostalgia bait. This whole, like, everything's a cinematic universe, everything's a reference to the thing you liked when you were a kid. It's been 20 years since Spider-Man 2, so it's time to bring back some of the villains. But I don't know. To me, that, like, I'm a huge fan of Spider-Man 2, might be my overall favorite Spider-Man movie. This apparently is an amalgamation of the Raimi Spider-Man movies and the plot of Enter the Spider-Verse, which is the other best Spider-Man movie.
It wasn't like, by Disney. They saw this and thought, oh, wait a minute, we should do something actually good.
What are some things people like about Spider-Man? Okay, it's these two previous films we didn't make. All right, so let's borrow some aspects of that. To me, it's only cheapening Spider-Man 2 to bring back the villain. The whole point, I don't know, spoilers for a 20-year-old movie. The point of the ending there was like a heroic sacrifice, redeeming the villain, like bringing him back to be a villain in a multiverse, to me just seems like a dumb idea. I'm sure it'll be better executed than that, but like, then again, I was sure that the Emperor Palpatine being in Rise of Skywalker wouldn't be as stupid as it sounded, and there we go.
See, I like the multiverse approach. I mean, I remember, I still have more nostalgia and joy from recollection of watching Spider-Man 2002 than I have for any of the other Marvel films. And I'll say that for Spider-Man 2, even though I do prefer the first Spider-Man film, a great fight to have there. I like that we can, I don't think it's actually cheap to bring it back as part of multiverse. I don't believe this will retcon, or otherwise can retcon the old films. My general philosophy of this is that they can be enjoyed and viewed in isolation. If it's good for any measure, then it's worth it for me to see him in this. I'm semi looking forward to this. I can't get too excited. I'm more excited for what we're going to talk about this week, honestly.
The problem with the multiverse thing is this is all about Doctor Strange, right?
Yeah.
Interesting that Doctor Strange, the new film, is being directed by Sam Raimi. I wonder if his making that was part of a way to have him part of the family and, you know, tacitly approving of the using of his characters in the Spider-Man movies, that they're not letting him direct Strange. But that just seems to be furthering the thing of Peter Parker not standing on his own and being back up to other MCU heroes, replacing Iron Man.
And he does have a particular arc given his age trajectory and where he is. He's not the consummate, I've saved the world several times.
I get it.
Others are. He's but like 18.
To me, that just illustrates the problem of these films where everything has to be huge all the time. And they're like, oh, he's the kid, so he doesn't, you know. Why can't he just be friendly neighborhood Spider-Man, who's a teenager, who's basically stands alone, because the point of Spider-Man is how much he carries on his shoulders. Spider-Man's way more effective if he stands as a hero on his own, I think.
Agreed. Because Marvel has decided that being a loner teenager is no longer cool, because angsty teenagers are bad, and we're just all part of a family. So, you know, everybody needs to be brought into the fold.
Mm-hmm. Avengers family.
Everyone has family now, so it's sad.
And family's good. And we don't know if Spider-Man will be good. That'll be coming out in a few months, maybe. The
Matrix is coming out at the same time, and that still doesn't have a trailer. Where's the outcry about that?
I don't need a trailer for The Matrix. I don't want a trailer for The Matrix. I'm just going to go see it. I rewatched the trilogy a couple of weekends ago. Society really did Revolutions and Reloaded Dirty. They're both fantastic films, as is, of course, the first one.
Yeah, I'm pretty keen to rewatch the sequels. Maybe we can talk about that in a few months when we may be about to watch The Matrix, maybe.
We'll see. Gladly. The philosophy, it's so philosophically dense and interesting and debatable, and I like that. It didn't give easy, direct answers and easy tie-ups when people were demanding it. So cool. And it was different to the original. Each was successful ones with different films. Anyway, we'll talk about The Matrix down the line. The other big film news of the week is just breaking the past 24 hours, is that it looks like there's prospective legislation as regards the security law in Hong Kong that films are both in the future and retrospectively may longer be available to keep in line with this law. We don't, nothing's been passed as of yet, but we can continue to cover it as it develops.
It will be passed though, because it's a proposed law where there's essentially no opposition. It will be passed. But yeah, it gives the right to retroactively ban films that have previously, or by the former administration, been approved. So it's a terrible day for Hong Kong's film history. You know, they've existed for a long time independent, and up until, I guess, the change started really happening strongly around the 2000. But Hong Kong used to be, of course, the main film industry of China, essentially, because they existed without restrictions and exported a lot more content and made some real classics. So it's a real shame.
Yeah, we believe films are there to be watched. So we'll continue this, we'll cover the story as it develops. Before we get into the Melbourne International Film Festival and Sun Children, to note the news of the week, the Indian Film Festival in Melbourne is streaming currently until the 30th of August. The West End Film Festival is screening online until the 31st. Starting today is both the Adelaide Film Festival for Youth and Cinefest Oz over in Perth. From the 1st of September, the Irish Film Festival will be streaming online to the 12th of September, joining a number of festivals that will be streaming online in September, including Queer Screen and the Sydney Underground Film Festival, which kicks off from the weekend of August, September 3rd to 5th, with the Take 48 filmmaking competition. We've done it in previous years, but I've done both past years, so as Chris, it's a lot of fun. We recommend you do it, and you can still register to do it online and be part of the program come when the festival begins, streaming from the 9th to the 26th of September. Also in Carriage Works, the Invocation Trilogy has some digital installations which are viewable online, were initially viewable over at Carriage Works in Everleigh, will be available from this Saturday, something to check out. The next Kino Sydney, they took a break in August, but they're coming up on the 14th of September. It'll be online, so you can still get your flicks in. And you can get details of all those festivals and more up at festivez.com. Notably, there's been a number, in addition to coverage we've made in the last week, a number of festivals were postponed, including the Armenian Festival, while a number of festivals, the Jewish International Film Festival has gone on from October to February, as has the Canberra International Film Festival. The Canberra run of the Korean Film Festival was postponed to October, and the Taiwan Film Festival has gone fully online. So the current pandemic is continuing to have quite an impact on the festival scene, and we'll bring you more coverage of that in coming weeks. You're listening to Film Fight Club and 2SCR with Glenn Falcons and Chris Evans of Rutneru. Next film we're talking about is Sun Children, which screened as part of the Melbourne International Film Festival. It is an Iranian film. In the great Iranian tradition of Iranian cinema, a young boy and his friends who are hired by some shady guys to dig up a treasure under a school. There's more to the plot, but I think it's a fair outline. This is a strange fusion of both the Goonies 80s era children's films and heist flicks like Gone in 60 Seconds. We've seen both of these sorts of genres happen in isolation, but to see elements thereof fused together is quite novel and interesting for me, which was enough for hook for me to see this film in and of itself.
Yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't say it's so much of a heist movie. It just has the elements of it, you know, because I felt like what becomes more pronounced is the kind of inspirational children's story, inspirational teacher triumph.
No question. This is also an inspirational feature film. A lot is going on here.
Yeah. The possibly even too much, even though it's quite a simple film. But because some aspects of the plot seemed really to fly over and you know, be hard to take in for me. But also I would note this, the subtitles on the copy of the film we got were pretty bad. And it's
yes, Mad Max there was grammatical errors.
Yeah, and they also were just quite unclear. They seem to be designed to be as short as possible, and maybe that's a literal translation of
Tahriban, so the Farsi term for approximately.
Right. Yeah, I'm not. I guess you would know if it's closer to like how Farsi is spoken generally, but it was not conveying enough detail to sound natural in English to me.
Yeah, it kind of felt like this was the shortest possible route to convey the gist of what was said rather than the nuance of what was said.
Yeah.
I think that's what the problem was.
Yeah. I didn't feel much watching this film, to be honest. I thought it was okay, but I thought it was very nicely directed. Yeah, I don't know. Look, the director of this, Majid Majidi, he used to have his films play late at night on SBS all the time. He was decried by the Jonathan Rosenbaums of the world as the accessible mainstream Miramax Iranian director in the 90s, as opposed to the artsy Kiarostami Jafar Panahi approach.
He broke out with the Children of Heaven, right, which was a massive, massive hit. I mean,
everyone loved
that film.
But that film, Color of Paradise, that sort of thing, they're so much more like the platonic ideal of an Iranian film, like minimal settings, minimal camera work, slow, warm human angle comes out. When this started, before his name, I hadn't read that he directed it yet, and before his name flashed on screen, I was like, oh, who's this new director? Digital handheld camera work, like it's a Bourne movie with the zooms and fast cutting and everything. Guys kept up with the times. The directing is good. You're definitely in the hands of an old pro.
I think the directing is good. My issue with it is that, and it is certainly resplendent in the moments, but I think this is a film that in its design and the way it is staged and staggered is produced so much, is designed so much to produce an effect, but what so many American films are forced to do is to produce powerful moments. And there are a lot of good moments. My favorite
visual moments.
The scene where the children are climbing the gates of the school, incredible. Some of the digging scenes, some of the sequences at the turnstiles on the train. There are some wonderful shots in this, but this film remains a memory of this, having watched it very recently, as a number of snippets as opposed to more of a cohesive whole. I feel this.
I agree.
And I go back to the 80s. I've heard of the Goonies earlier. It's not a film I actually like very much. As I would say the same for a lot of those 80s films, where it is of 80s kids get together. And with the exception of Stand By Me, these were also designed to produce aha moments to be incredibly marketable, rather than be some sort of narrative thematic hole. I think it does come together at the very end, even though the ending is a bit obvious. I think that was...
There needed to be, I think, more either more emphasis or a different angle if this is the way the plot was going to play out, because it's so just kind of like a foregone conclusion. It's like, oh, like you don't feel what I'm sure is meant to be like a deeper kind of moral to the whole thing.
It was clear where this was going.
Yeah. It is a very Hollywood film in some ways, and yet very Iranian in others, right? It's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, Majidi is doing some interesting things, not only in this film, I think in its later in his career, because his previous film was a Hindi language film, which I was not expecting.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, and he made basically a grown-up version of basically his first film, the breakout film, Children 7. But he made that in completely in Hindi, not knowing the language, which is also interesting. But he seems to be very interested in now social justice issues.
He always was, I think.
Of his filmmaking, all of them. But now I think more so, because
even more so, right?
This film has basically all the child actors are basically crews from the street, and they're being picked up, and they're not camera ready, essentially. But that's also really, the charm of the film.
The main child actor is incredible in this.
He is really good. They feel like a gang. They feel authentic. And the main guy is really good. He has an incredible face, but he has this bit of a static performance throughout. He has this amazing sad look that is
basically... But he keeps playing it every scene.
The entire film.
Yeah.
It's a little bit much. Like, he's good. It's just... There's all I'm seeing in each scene.
Well, that kind of gets at the greater problem with the film itself, which is I feel like it's a little bit cloying and manipulative and like continuing to hit this one kind of note.
You will feel sad at the loss of child. There's a child of innocence, and you will feel sad at its loss.
I remembered
it's relevant, but it's I refer to something like it's unfair to compare this to films like Stand By Me, but it really pushes the you will feel something for these children who will, and here are your ascendant moments where you will have this crescendo of emotion as opposed to this slow burn. Again, we refer to Hollywood versus traditional and better Iranian filmmaking.
That's right. I remember, I'm sure it was Rosenbaum, but some review, it might have been of a movie he made in the early 2000s or 2010s, I saw it about an ostrich farmer, I think. I can't remember much of it, but I think it was Rosenbaum reviewing it. He said something about how Majidi's films are too focused on moral instruction. You feel that in this movie. Around the time that I stopped following what he was doing, up until catching up with him again with this movie, I remember that he'd made this Prophet Muhammad movie where he got Vittorio Storaro to be the cinematographer. You would need a great DP for that project, because the idea was that light is always obscuring the Prophet Muhammad's face.
Yeah.
Interesting experiment, right? I haven't seen the film, but I'm very curious.
And I think the ostrich movie is Song of Sparrows.
That's the one. That's the one.
Yeah. But he always has very good visual sort of sense of how to actually construct scenes.
That's it. He's an extremely
beautiful.
Technically,
it's just that all his stories are sometimes... the problem he has is like his filmmaking sometimes gets obscured by the moral tale that he wants to tell.
Here's how to be a good Muslim.
And overpowers.
That's always what it's about.
Yeah.
You know, and like, and the movie's on the side of good, which is, you know, can make for interesting art, but let's just say that that kind of like fixed doctrine of like, I'm going to give you a moral is not always in service of dramatic complexity.
I'd refer to something like a separation of one of the great Iranian films of the past 10 years, where it is highly morally instructive, but that plays second fiddle to a surprising and dominant narrative and dramatic focus.
Yeah, Fahadi is very good at having a range of different characters of different stances and constructing drama out of that.
Even Panahi's early films, where he uses kids as basically, whether it's the white balloon, or Offside, you know, great moral films, but the morality of the film isn't really overtaking the actual, you know, experience of cinema.
No, and the message making is strong, but somehow, I guess it's that he tries to go for a less dogmatic kind of conclusion here.
Yeah.
Now, the ending of this is just, as Glenn said.
And I didn't appreciate the dedication aspect. I'm like, it's so obvious this is what the film is about. He didn't need to dedicate it to, you know.
Yeah.
It's something that we...
Yeah.
the moral of the story, like I'm going to go and talk about the White Lotus a little later, which deals with a moral subject, transactional relationships, which you don't often see discussed, and that there's a little level. This, as good as it is something that we know the moral of this. We don't, it's instructive from the beginning and from many other films we've seen. Something I did like, however, and moreover, in light of the horror that is coming out of Kabul and around Afghanistan right now, there is a huge focus on the Afghani community in Iran, particular, and Afghani refugee community in Iran, through the focus of the young woman. And I really liked that. The film, I think, will be more relevant to, even more relevant than it would have been at the time of filmmaking, to a current audience who is seeing what is unfolding. And I think it was a mature and good focus. So I,
yeah,
I like
that. I agree with that. And you're right. It did seem very topical watching it now. I think there's going to be a lot more Afghans in Iran, I guess.
Well, Iran have closed the border as they
have,
and patrol it and have as they have in the past. So that's another dimension. But yes, I believe there will be more, certainly there'll be films coming out focusing on what is currently happening and evolving in Afghanistan and how that plays into the surrounding countries.
But they won't be made in Afghanistan.
I'm glad to know some filmmakers have been able to escape to safety in the last few days, which I was worried about. The filmmaker Sharbano Sadat, whose film premiered at the Sydney Film Festival, Wolf and Sheep. She was caught up in Kabul and she's been able to escape to France with her family. So that's probably one piece of good news we can probably see. And she said in a statement that she's wanting to make films now about what's happened. So I guess it's going to be documented pretty soon.
Yeah, great.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So that is Sun Children. You're listening to Film Fight Club on 2SER with Glenn Falkenstein, Chris Evans, and Bharat Nehru. The next film we're talking about, also from the International Film Festival, is Pickpocket.
Yeah, the Jia Zhangke's debut, which was very much like a mix of Bresson and Godard, early Godard. It's very French New Wave.
Yeah, but it's also very Italian neorealism.
Yeah.
It's... Because
nothing really happens in the film, if you think about it.
No, like, that's true.
It's about nothing.
It's so minimal. I found it hard to get into this, to be honest.
Yeah,
this film is from 1997, but it comes to us in a newly restored version, thanks to Martin Scorsese's World Cinema Project and the Cineteca Bologna, always doing their bit to restore cinema treasures and historically notable films. Jia is, of course, now one of the most notable Chinese filmmakers. And he especially broke out internationally with his next film, Platform.
And I think this might be one of the films that might also get affected by the censorship thing, because even though it plays out in a very minimal way, it is in the backdrop of the transfer of sovereignty of Hong Kong in 97. So there is some controversial element to that, even though it doesn't really play into the film, but
the
political commentary is there, which might...
No, I think this movie will be okay, because it passed mainland censors the first time, and I'm pretty, you know... Jia has always been good at skirting the line as far as censorship goes. Yeah. But yeah, he makes some pretty...
What I see this film as, it's basically starting of the collaboration between his DOP and himself, because the visual composition of this film was amazing and beautiful. Apart from that, there's not much in this film.
I thought it was okay. It's basically about, as the title says, a pickpocket. It's not that much. It's not much like Bresson's film, which is a much more moralistic kind of story. I think this is, you know, about a pickpocket and called Pickpocket in homage, and has some aspects in common. But it's basically just showing a character who is a pickpocket. He's an interesting character in his detachment from. It's really a character study. He's detached from everybody, He's
attached from his his close family members, his friends, society, institutions. It's basically man versus every other element.
Yeah,
he doesn't fit in. It's that kind of a film.
He's kind of inscrutable and doesn't show much emotion until halfway through. So the whole time you're wondering what this guy's deal is.
Yeah,
and
basically like angsty teenager tantrum, but
he's like in his 20s, right? And the point is that people are going on to have great jobs and getting married, etc. And he's this kind of loner pickpocket guy who keeps running into trouble with the law. Conceptually interesting, just studying this guy, but I found it too static, I guess. It created
static, intrigue, it's too repetitive. The kind of it keeps coming back to that same circle of like, this person can't break that cycle, but there's nothing new to it. You've seen it in the first 20 minutes. The cycle keeps repeating with different elements thrown in, with different kind of conflicts. But the conflicts aren't even that, not heightened as such.
It's going for realism, but yeah. I feel like there needed to be either more aspects to this character or more dramatically interesting scenarios at a certain point.
This kind of worn out. This could be better if this was just a sort of elongated short, like an extended short, like of less than an hour, so 45 minutes or something, and this would have worked well.
Or this character, a part of a larger narrative, multi-strand, perhaps.
Yeah.
But pickpocket.
Yep. I mean, it's still good. It establishes the key players,
it's well directed.
Key relationships and stuff, and you can see the early promise there.
Yeah, it's an interesting character.
That's about it.
Yeah.
Right. Thank you. So that is Pickpocket. In the last few minutes, we're going to talk about The White Lotus, which is now streaming on Binge. Excuse me to correct myself from earlier. It's become very popular in the very immediate short term. It is starring Jake Lacy, Alexandra Daddario, Steve Zahn, Murray Bartlett, who I saw the other day. He's an Australian local, and the accent is real. It's nice to see Australians on screen without having it being shoved down. I'm sorry. Oh, it's an Australian. It also stars the promising young woman, a triple of Connie Britton, Jennifer Coolidge, and Molly Shannon. I think more of a coincidence than anything else. It is about a retreat for rich people to Hawaii. We are told at the beginning of the series that a person has died at the titular resort, the White Lotus. And then we flash back 1 week to the beginning of the retreat for a group of people where we follow four different storylines from a family, the hotel manager, a couple, and a lady who's quite wealthy, played by Jennifer Coolidge. So it's a classic bomb under the table situation. As said before, this is a show about transactional relationships and how race and class play into this. And also particularly as regards to the setting in Hawaii as elements of Indigenous exploitation. I think the series errs a bit by not making the distinction as regards race and class when it comes to transactional relationships. However, I appreciate that the particular conflicts shown here are endemic to the particular setting, and the setting is very well defined.
The show is about white people, right? It's about
the show is about rich white people. It's about rich white people.
That's fine.
Being feckless and careless and entitled. So it's a comedy, but there's also quite strong dramatic elements. And it's something that anyone who's worked in the service industry can relate, because there's a particular character who's just entitled and thinks he's on his honeymoon with his beautiful wife, but he wants the suite that he was promised, even though it wasn't as good as the suite they ultimately gave him. Everyone knows someone like this. I'm referring to the Jake Lacy character. He's great. I think he's the real pivot of the series.
How many episodes is this?
There are six. There are 6 hour long episodes.
Okay. So it sort of fits the film Fight Club. It's a long movie.
It's a long movie. Yeah, this is something they could have made as a movie. I'm glad they didn't. They let the characters play out over each successive episodes. And it's nice to consume this as I did week after week after week. Each episode is a day in the life of this week. Therefore, I think it works quite well. I'm watching Chapel Wait in the same way, as we'll discuss in a moment.
So you were watching this show before the ending, which seems to have gotten a lot more people interested in this.
The ending has absolutely got a lot of people interested. A lot of it was like a good Hitchcock film, leading towards the end. What is going to happen? Who is, we're told someone's going to die. We don't know who it is. And I think it does stick the landing. I thought it could go one of two ways. It went the second way I thought it could go. I was still genuinely surprised at how it played out. And I can't talk about this without spoilers, but I like the way it played out because it shows such a strong sense of entitlement. We're going to talk a little bit more about White Lotus in the podcast. We're also going to be talking about Chapelwaite and a number of Myth Flicks, Moon 66 Questions, Stray, Le Civil, and Rock Bottom Riser.
I'll also give, for the internet crowd, my brief thoughts on the new Evangelion film on Amazon Prime.
Fantastic. And please stay tuned for The Sonic Assassin. Tune in next week, where we're going to be going back to non-festival films just for the moment. We're going to be talking about Val, which is streaming also on Amazon Prime. And unironically, my most anticipated film of the year, He's All That, the spiritual, if not actual sequel to She's All That. Stay tuned for The Sonic Assassin. Have a wonderful night. Stay safe. This has been Glenn Falconside, Chris Evans of Rotten Their Room before Rotten Their Room explodes with laughter. Enjoy movies. Good night. And welcome back to Film Fight Club, where we are talking all things White Lotus. Yes, I am excited for Here's All That. It stars Rachel Lee Cook as the mom. I love that movie. I love even more the parody, Not Another Teen Movie, which may be the best teen movie of that era.
What I'm going to say is, how far have the mighty fallen after Mip to He's All That? I mean, we're really the bastions of progress.
What's to say this film won't be a masterpiece like He's All That? And moreover, none of the
team. I'm sure it's going to be a masterpiece. It's going to be like The Kissing Booth 1, 2, and 3. It's going to be one of the most popular films on Netflix, or like Never Have I Ever. But does it deserve any kind of critical lens or appreciation? Probably not. But
let's go compromise. I haven't seen it. We still have some unwatched MIF screeners. So me and Virat will watch the Love Diaz movie, and maybe we can review that if we can't as well. If we can't.
Love Diaz, now he's All That. He's a lot more than
all that. I don't think there's ever been a more Fight Club statement than Love Diaz, now he's All That.
That's a brand.
Oh dear, oh no. No, but like I wrote back to the She's All That, and it was very contemporary. Like there was all these great parodies of, I think the MTV show was called The Real World, showing my age here. And this is going to be very much of the TikTok world. So yeah, it's modern, it's contemporary. I'm keen. Yeah, He's All That.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just watched Josie and the Pussycats the first time, speaking of Rachel Lee Cook. She's excellent. All That. It's great. She is All That.
Fun movie, isn't it? Josie and the Pussycats.
It's so good. I'm not sure if we spoke about this on or off air, but the scene where she wipes the cocaine to reveal like the secret underground government controller is one of my all-time favorite gags.
Hilarious. It's so perfectly Alan Cumming as well, his role in that film.
I loved him. The smile, the fourth wall breaks were just perfectly timed.
Yeah.
He's great in there. Actually, this may be his best role.
It's the most perfectly suited to him.
He was pretty good in the Spy Kids movies as well.
Those movies were not good. I'm sorry, I'm going to die on that hill, but I can't stand those films.
Oh, come on.
You guess is worse.
You're going to like go for She's All That, but not Spy Kids? I'm like, come on.
She's All That is a funny, light parody of teen movies, but also has real characters, which was entertaining. Spy Kids is a dumb action film with bad CGI.
Exactly, it's amazing. Spy Kids is amazing.
And maybe this was my too cool for film school era, and maybe they deserve to go back and be rewatched. But I just never liked him when I was a kid. I could not handle Spy Kids.
Wow.
And what did Rodriguez's other films? I was into his actual movies.
Whoa, actual movies.
Even as a kid, like Spy Kids. I want to see From Dusk Till Dawn.
Damn straight.
Yeah.
Netflix keeps recommending me From Dusk Till Dawn. Like I've seen it. That's great. All these films are great.
Don't you want to watch it again, Glenn? The algorithm thinks you're interested.
Yeah.
It does. You know what the algorithm thinks? Okay, I never seen this film. I didn't know what it was about. Netflix keeps recommending to me The Girl Next Door. So I watched it last night, not knowing anything about it. It's mostly awful.
What is
this film? Isn't that the Jennifer Lopez erotica film?
No, it's Elisha Cuthbert and Emile Hirsch.
Oh, yeah.
And it's about he falls for the pretty girl next door who it turns out is an adult film star. It's the first act is kind of okay and actually has some nice romantic scenes and then just goes into full chauvinist territory.
Okay.
It's pretty bad. Just avoid. Like one of those.
Very dated.
By a bunch of dudes. And I don't think aged well then. And certainly.
I think it was popular in the during the first American Pie movies time.
It's a bit after. Like American, at least I don't like the other American Pie films. I didn't mind Aliens from American Union. The first American Pie film, there was actually reasonable arcs. They learned things that it's okay to not feel peer pressure. There was some incredible sexism. All the stuff for the webcam.
Apparently they made a new one that came out last year.
Otherwise, like there's some genuinely funny sequences in the first American Pie. I loved Eugene Levy in it. Like it is still one of the better teen films of that era. Again, nothing on Not Another Teen Movie.
But I think apparently they made a new American Pie film last year where they flipped the genders. Basically the same characters, but what if they were female? So we have a female version of Stifler. We have a female version of, you know, you get
the one of the worst Hollywood trends is the gender swap version. It's like,
hey guys, get excited for He's All That.
I know.
This is what's happening.
Keep the same.
What if it was the same story, but
How can we use the same brand as a pre-existing thing, but appear to be keeping up with the times with female representation? Let's, you know, it's the worst compromise.
Just yeah, I mean, that one objectified.
How great was Booksmart?
Yeah, one objectified women. So why don't we objectify guys this time around?
But Booksmart, even though it was like gender swap Superbad, at least was not like Superbad. At least it was Booksmart and had some aspects that were directly about female friendship.
I'm being mostly facetious.
Yeah, yeah.
We all are right now. But it's also kind of like...
No, I think this is generally fair criticism here. Make original properties. Well,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
I mean, He's All That might be actually a decent film, but it's just that...
Maybe.
Thank you for acknowledging.
I was trying to say that with a straight face, Chris. Come on.
So, The White Lotus, yes, that is on binge right now. It's proved very, very popular.
Did you have more to say on it?
A few things. One of them actually interesting major trends about it is that it really dives into issues of toxic masculinity. And I like that the series is mature enough to make, to both depict and make a distinction between what is a more increasingly egregious forms of toxic masculinity and also issues of mental health that are regularly experienced by men as distinct, which are important issues that need to be addressed and covered that men routinely and typically feel. I like that there were four distinct stories that didn't feel that was overwhelmed. Again, if this was in a film, I think we could have just seen choppy editing to get everything packed in, but we were able to follow everyone with quite ease. I loved Britain's quite nuanced CEO of a tech company. I thought she was really good. I liked the daughter's arc and Dario's. I think the key, again, with the key to the series is really the Jake Lacy character. He's more clueless than he is feckless. And I think both the actor and the narrative get this and makes him more sympathetic than he otherwise could have been. I think that's really crucial to the appeal of the show. As said, the ending was good. Something that really frustrated me was the sound design. And there's a lot of repetitive motifs. I hate the Boston Legal approach to want people to get upbeat now. So we just play the music whenever someone says something. I feel there's a lot of that in here, which could have been excised. Finally, there's a key scene in this where a character says two persons of color are having a discussion and they say, these people, they're the people who screwed you over. And the response is, no, these aren't those people. And the other person says, yes, these are those people. This is a very important and philosophical discussion to be had. And a lot is debated less maturely in a lot of cinema and film. I think how you fall on what side of that discussion or what you fall on will determine a lot of how you view the series. But I like that, however you do fall on either side of that discussion, that you can enjoy different dimensions thereof. I think this is a series that, without being judgmental, promotes debate and empathy on a lot of the issues discussed. And therefore, I quite liked it. I think it's a step above the vast majority of television that I've seen recently, and that is generally on. Not as good as a lot of the myth flicks we've covered, because, hey, we've been spoiled for choice. But I thought it was good. I think it is justifiably getting a lot of good traction. I can see it getting a sequel with a new resort and or a new bunch of people. It could happen, I don't know, but it was it was 6 hours I mostly enjoyed. So that is The White Lotus, and not The Blue Lotus. Sorry, as the Tintinologist I am, I keep getting the two confused, but it is The White Lotus. The next film we are talking about is From Myth, Moon 66 Questions.
Yeah, this was very Greek New Wave, but quite a bit warmer. The kind of post-Yorgos Lanthimos era of Greek films with a lot of strange characters and awkward scenes being awkward and strange. This is basically about an estranged daughter coming back to look after her father, who has an autoimmune disease. So he requires pretty close physical care. And there's a bit of an abstracted narrative going on in the background as we find out a little bit more about what exactly caused the two to be so estranged. It's never directly clear, but there's enough here that you can infer and get the point of it. The main character is portrayed by an extraordinary actress and is a very strikingly weird character. We spend a lot of time in her in private moments, sort of like making voices to herself and acting things out. But she wasn't so off-puttingly weird, as I found in a lot of Greek weird wave, the characters to be, that I couldn't directly empathize with her. There's some very, very strong visual language in this film that situates you in the world of the characters. And I found it aesthetically interesting enough that it carried me through the sections where the drama was a little bit vague. But I think this film succeeds more than a lot of these obscure extended shot film-esque art house films you see playing at festivals, because there actually is depth there that gradually comes to the surface, and there's a surprising amount of warmth that gradually emerges in the relationship between these two characters. It's ultimately a very simple story about familial love that's been transfigured through this weird prismatic chopped up art film strategy. But yeah, I found it really interesting. It reminds me a bit of Lynn Ramsey's first film, Ratcatcher. And it's a filmmaker who is known for very strong short films exploring family relationships, making this kind of abstracted expansion of that to the feature length form. Yeah, she's clearly, as Lynn Ramsey was, a really strong visual director, really great at creating atmospheres. And I have a feeling she has a really strong future ahead of her. So yeah, this was one of the better films I saw at MIFF.
And the next film also that was covered as part of MIFF was Stray.
Yeah, I can never resist a good dog documentary. This is about the stray dogs of Istanbul. It's a counterpiece, I would say, to the film about the stray cats of Istanbul from a few years ago, Kedi. This is a better film in my eyes. Kedi was very bourgeois documentary, I guess, showing you the upper class people in Istanbul, very like his how this is a cosmopolitan city, and but all the cats are integrated into it. By the numbers, kind of boring. This is like a cinema verite following dogs around the city, watching how they get by. To me, it's really interesting, just like watching them go for a garbage bag in the middle of the street and find a bone and try and find a space where they can eat the bone. I don't know, if you love watching dogs, you'll find interest in this. The thing is, what makes it more interesting than Kedi, but also leans into it being a little bit heavy-handed, dogs are protected in Istanbul now because there's been a history of so much violence against them. The counterpoint of Kedi is pretty clear because, cats are given prized status in Islam, and dogs are less so. A lot of people hate dogs, to be clear. So this film, which I think is made by an American crew mostly, seems to be equating the stray dogs to refugees. We spend a lot of time spending with a group of Syrian children with nowhere to stay, whose lives intersect with the dogs, and they want to look after them for a while. And if anything, I found this movie a little bit on the nose after a while. It's very serious, and it's about a very serious, noble dog with a very sad face. And it pushes this refugee analog, further than it needed to be, I think. So it comes across a little bit as like moralizing after a while, but it is interesting seeing how the dogs are basically tolerated. They're basically invisible to most people. Like it's illegal to commit violence against them, so most people just ignore them. But there's groups of people who do their bit to make sure they've got a place to stay, to make sure that they're looked after if they're sick, or that they're fed if they need to be. There's just enough people who care about doing the right thing for them to get by. It's a good film, but I'd recommend above it one from a few years ago from Chile called Los Reyes, which had a bit more humor to it. It similarly made
the... An Antenna, from memory.
It was an Antenna, yeah. That film similarly made the connection between dogs and kind of down and out people. But those dogs were a lot more expressive. The film spent a lot of time following like kind of like the whimsy of life, and more positive interactions with people, and while also containing social commentary and sadder aspects. And I found that movie just a lot less heavy-handed and a lot more fully featured and fully developed as a narrative. So I'd recommend that one. But this is still some extraordinary documentary filmmaking. The final, I don't want to spoil it because it's the best part of the film if you're going to watch it, but the final scene that plays over the credits is pretty extraordinary. I'm going to tell you guys when we stop recording. I just want to talk about that aspect of the film, really, but it would be wrong to give it away. Stray is still a good documentary. It knows it's time to end at about 70 minutes. There wasn't like much more they could do.
That we otherwise see.
Yeah.
Like The Girl Next Door, which went on for 2 hours. God damn.
Right, damn.
Yeah. It's a big issue. Many films overstay their welcome. It's nice when it's okay for a film to be 60 minutes, honestly.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
Oh, I think it was The Boy Next Door. Sorry, I was just confusing with the Jennifer Lopez one that came out recently. And I think, yeah, that was called The Boy Next Door, if I'm not mistaken. Okay. Also a horrible film, but just, titles.
Oh, yeah. The Girl Next Door, it could have been good if it had not been for the sexism. I mean, Emile Hirsch was great. And so is Large Cuthbert, but yeah. So the next film what we're talking about, Better, is currently streaming on Stan. The first three episodes have been released. They're being released weekly. And that is Chapelwaite. It is a Stephen King adaptation starring Adrian Brody. He plays a whaler in the early 18th century who relocates his three children from the Sea of Japan to, following the death of his wife and their mother, to a creepy New England mansion.
Are there any others in Stephen King stories? Are there only mansions in New England in Stephen King stories? Are they ever not creepy?
I liked the series a lot, except it made me think, there's after watching The Sleepy Hollows of the Water, we watched that recently. Were there any towns in the early 19th century New England that just weren't creepy? Where things just went on as normal, where things were there was disease and there was some poverty, but everything was kind of a-okay. People got on. I don't know. I don't think so.
Also, by whaler, do you mean a master at crying? Because I think Adrian Brody is a very good whaler. He wails quite beautifully when he wants to.
No, I mean, and this is kind of glossed over a bit, but this is in the era pre-finding oil in the ground. So that he went to see Japan to kill whales. He was the captain. As a captain, you could have your kids and your wife on the ship. It actually reminded me, a bit of a very underrated film, In the Heart of the Sea, which aside from the beginning and epilogue and prologue was a very, very enjoyable classic style adventure. Anyway, this is not that. This is a sad film about a sad series about every town in New England, apparently, which was always creepy. And they go to this town, they inherit, he has a terrible childhood we see an prologue where a rather terrible event happens with his father, which continues to haunt him. And we know that he had a falling out, that side of his family had a falling out with his side of the family. However, he's inherited this mansion and this estate. However, the townsfolk in Breach's Corner do not trust him or his family because of the history with his family. And therein, there's a neat metaphor for racism because his kids are the only persons of color in the whole town. It's a good metaphor, which isn't overly belabored. It is made a little obvious at times. The person who holds the ledger who works in Boone's, that's the Andrew Brody character, Sawmill, is also a person of color. And a bit of the racism that plays it is at the time and still an issue, obviously very much an issue in America, plays out through that character as well. I think that was quite well handled. There are a lot of horror motifs that you've seen, some that you haven't. The worms are the choice here. They're pretty good. They're pretty eerie, but not in your face eerie. It doesn't mistake sheer let's get in your face, let's throw this at you for actually trying to be unnerving. There's a really good twist on the creepy girl with the long unmatted hair and the white dress. It's established when we see this figure that it's not actually a fantasy, that this is happening in real life repeatedly, but we don't really know what the context is or why it is happening. Certainly we know it may be connected to an illness that is pervaded the town, and this is something I'm actually quite curious about, as is the without ruining anything, the shadowy figure which seems to be related to some classic Gothic symbolism, which I quite like. So I will obviously see where those elements go. There is a Hallows Eve, like a early Halloween. The production design of the town, I find, is quite standard. What elevates this is the Brody performance and the mystery story itself. Look, it's just good, reliable King. Stephen King annotations are good because they come from very good, extremely good source material. And you have an actor who's never given a bad performance at the front of this film. There are a couple of moments where I feel in the hands of with less competent director and actors, it could have verged into comedic territory, just because we've seen this creepy town so many times before, but it never goes over that precipice. It is predominantly scary and eerie, and I'm enjoying it without being just too, there's more of an emphasis on the drama than the horror, which is something I prefer. And I'm enjoying it. I'm going to keep watching it. It's something I like that it's coming out bit by bit by bit. It wasn't made to be binged. It was made to be enjoyed in succession, like a classic serial, like most good horrors are. And that is Chapawait, which is now streaming on Stan. And the next thing with film we're talking about is Rock Bottom Riser.
Yeah. I had to watch something experimental during MIFF, and it's part of the territory of the festival. This is described as like a psychedelic, free associative essay film exploring Hawaii. I was really on board at first with sequences showing the flow of lava, the proximity of lava to civilization in Hawaii, which is really quite incredible. The formation of new land masses under the sea and the ways that the roads have been disrupted sometimes by volcanic activity. All of that is great. The transition into it becoming more than kind of a landscape film, I don't think was so well handled. When things are just like, for lack of a better word, artsy, and it's just a turnoff. Like we spend 6 minutes.
You will appreciate this as cinema.
Yeah, we spend 6 minutes watching a lecture about, very scientific lecture that is not that interesting. Sequences are allowed to play out
very well Ayn past. Rand.
Yeah, things are allowed to play out well past their expiry date. Like we're watching a scene of people in a classroom discussing, and I can't even remember what they were discussing now, but it turns into a montage with the song, and it goes on for like the whole length of the song. And I was thinking like, end the scene, there's no reason for this. But there was some incredibly cool footage of volcanoes and some, it becomes about the telescopes and in Hawaii and regional, opposition to them from the indigenous tribes for disrupting their mountains, essentially, and the significance the mountains have, which I found interesting, but I know it would be against the point of making a weird video art-esque festival film, but I would have preferred a more in-depth exploration of those issues or a more tangible trajectory to those themes. I guess I'm just a pleb who was outsmarted by this film.
So before we go on to the next film, to note something I didn't actually mention about White Lotus, which is also set in Hawaii, is that there is a particular storyline which does delve into issues of how indigenous people have been treated by people who have invaded and taken over the land, indigenous exploitation. And this is arguably, I think, the best element of the show. Plays out in a way that was genuinely surprising and genuinely cutting. Like that is, of all the things I remember from this, notwithstanding the ending, it's that. So right. I give credit where credit's due. Next up, Le Civil.
Yeah, I'll go in brief on this because I have to be honest, I didn't finish this film. I meant to, I had 30 minutes left in it and I was sick of it and I had other stuff to do. So I thought I'll get back to it later. And then later on I watched other films and then I ran out of time when I guess I could have found the time if I really tried, but it shows my lack of investment in this. This I found to be like misery porn of the lowest order.
To be clear, in festivals, it's okay because you watch so many films, this happens.
Yeah.
And specifically with the timer, like we were cut off at midnight, like Cinderella, MIFF.
Yeah. But I just didn't care. You know, this is a long movie. I watched more than 100 minutes of it.
Where is it set?
Okay, so this is in Mexico.
Okay.
This was funded, it was produced by a lot of art cinema darlings. Michel Franco, who I guess is less of a darling, but Christian Mungiu, I think, and the Dardenne brothers all produced it.
Man,
some scam must have been executed to pull all these people in. There's basically nothing to this. It's so by the numbers. And to me, it seemed like a movie that's designed for foreign sales. It's got it's about the cartels, right? And it's about a mother who will stop at nothing to rescue her daughter from the cartels. It's instantly sellable as like a Mexican export to international art film audiences. But it's just reveling in how bad and sad everything is, to the extent that I didn't really feel any life. The whole thing felt extremely familiar to me. It's basically like handheld camera work following this mother while she, she tries to track down, after her daughter's kidnapped, she tries to track down cartel people. She follows them around. She finds information which allows her to join a police team. So we're riding around. I know exactly.
So like it's just radio, but I just did a like weird look at Chris, not at Chris.
Raised eyebrows. Yeah, I questioned. Like you've given us this good information. Cool, you can ride along. Why would they allow that? Is this really what, like, I didn't buy into it either.
Breaking Bad at least had a plausible reason why Walter would go along with Hank for the first episode. Like that I kind of bought.
Yeah, so it's just a tour so that we can see how, get this, guys. Sometimes the highly militarized police in Mexico can be as bad as the cartels. Ooh, some cutting insights here. But it's like, you know, you get to see the corpses in the morgue and you get to see people being beaten by the police and you get to see the mutilated bodies hung up in places and you get to see the tragic relationship this woman has with her estranged partner and you get to feel the misery and it's all grimy and Mexico is a sad place, guys. No, I really didn't like this. I don't know how it ends. Maybe there's some huge redemption in the ending. I doubt it. But it seemed so insistent on being like a hard-hitting expose of human misery that it didn't allow for much life. And on top of that, it just felt familiar. I've seen all of this before. You know, I've seen all these scenes before.
It strikes me, I'm watched a lot of films with this lockdown. It's number 87. Two of them have evoked exactly what you've described, Chris. One is Tom Cruise from 83, Losing It, where these teenagers go to Mexico and it's their playground and they'd not care and everything there is dangerous, especially if you're a non-Mexican, not if you're not Mexican, excuse me. But the other one I saw more recently, I was on a Stallone fix. I saw Rambo Last Blood to complete all my Rambo watches. And this one, it's the worst one. He goes, actually, yeah, it is.
This is the Trump one, right?
This is the Trump one where he goes to Mexico to rescue his an adopted child, effectively. And it's the police are bad and won't help you. The cartels are bad, people are bad and everywhere. I appreciate there is a lot of crime in Mexico. It is a very serious thing. However, a lot of American and otherwise now as it appears European cinema treats it in from a very singular lens and as an aesthetic non-representative way, which is a big problem. I'd like to see more films that are actually representative of nuances there and what Mexico is really like, even with regards to the criminal dimensions.
Yeah, I'm not denying that the cartel are horrible, by the way.
These are bad guys.
Yeah, or that the police are horrible in their dealings with them. And I know it's a scary and serious issue and it is worthy of cinematic storytelling. But I didn't feel any noble goals coming from this film, to be honest. I found it quite ugly.
Yeah, I remember Sicario back in the day was good.
Sicario was better.
Yeah, Sicario was great.
I hate to say America did it better, but they did.
To note something about particularly egregious about Rambo Last Blood.
I'm curious about Rambo.
Well, look, the setup is she goes down, she's of Mexican background. She goes down there for the first time in her life to see her estranged, to find her estranged father. And I thought, okay, this is a minor discussion of minor plot points, minor spoilers for the first extended act. She goes down there and I think, okay, so the father is going to, I knew the plot was about a kidnap plot. They're holding her. I thought the father or someone connected to him or someone who otherwise connected to her, who she thought may have been her father, but may have been wrong, was going to exploit her and kidnap her. And like, okay, so this is a little bit improbable, but still plausible plot. It does sadly happen. But no, that's not what happened. She sees the father. The father's like, nothing to do with you. She goes to a club. It's a first night out clubbing in Mexico. She's 18 and she gets taken by the cartels. What's strange about this is this film had a more plausible, more reasonable setup for why Rambo would go down and try to rescue her. But then it goes into, no. If you go down to Mexico like Tom Cruise and losing it, you're going to get screwed over and the criminals are just going to be there for you because you are, because you're an American or from somewhere that's not Mexico. And
right.
Of all the egregious things about that film, that was just the most thereof. Like why? You had a... Wait, you had a better way to deal with this. Why? Again, it just plays into prejudice.
Right. Before we wrap up, since we've been covering, you know, stuff we've been watching, and I know there's been a flurry of interest from it all over the Twitter sphere recently, I thought I'll give you my thoughts briefly on Evangelion 3.0 plus 1.0 Thrice Upon a Time. The entire rebuild of Evangelion film series is on Amazon Prime now, which, you know, I think the 13th of August was when they released it. Lots of online attention again. Evangelion is an anime show that was very formative for me and a lot of other young males in the late 90s, I would say, going into early 2000s was its heyday of popularity. And there's been a remake series of four films trying to tell the story of the TV show in a different way. Now that it's over, I have to say that the whole thing just feels completely artistically unnecessary. And like the George Lucasization of a really classic series. To be fair about this George Lucas comparison, this is better than the Star Wars prequels. You know, it's better written and it's better directed. But the Star Wars prequels, I think, had more artistic integrity. I really don't see the need for telling this story again. Basically, that the show is famous for its lack of closure and its strange and abstract and question-raising ending. And the entire purpose of this film series, and especially this last film, seems to me to tell the story again, but this time with, you know, an ending that gives people closure. And I really wonder why people need closure from fictional stories. This has been interpreted a lot as
Matrix Revolutions.
Right. Yeah, this has been interpreted a lot by people as meta commentary from the creator of the show, Hideki Anno, who's famously ambivalent about the fandom, telling them, you know, go out and live your life. Don't get too obsessed with anime. Detach yourself. Lesson. Sorry?
Good lesson.
It is a good lesson, but I feel like, I don't know, the idea that you need to be given closure to do that, to me, is kind of like counter to what makes art interesting. I'm not saying I'm against unambiguously happy endings or closure, but I feel like all the things that enrich our lives and giving us something to think about, giving us something to discuss, tend to open to end with a little bit of ambiguity. This film is extremely rushed. It spends about an hour giving characters development that's been missing in the first three films of this series and been sorely lacking in comparison with the pacing of the TV show. And then the last 90 minutes of this film is in a rush to give every single character as neat and tidy a resolution as possible. And even though some of these scenes are well-written, well-directed, occasionally quite touching, to me, it just starts to feel like it's too much, it's too happy, it's happening too quickly, it's too neat, and I wasn't convinced. If you don't know what Evangelion is, it's about robots fighting aliens, by the way.
It's better than Transformers.
It's much better than Transformers. In brief, the action was fun to watch, even though it was total nonsense. The whole thing is anime nonsense. It doesn't make much sense on a plot level. I don't understand why people have been praising this. It's like if it gives me a happy ending, I can forgive that it basically makes no sense. You know, it's like it totally ends justify the means approach to storytelling. But it's an onslaught of CGI. It is horribly anime in the shameless way that it exploits sexuality of its female cast, in a way that the original ending of the show, the end of Evangelion, which is on Netflix, did not. Yeah, I don't know. I could talk about this movie for hours, but it's the end of an episode of Film Fight Club. I'll just say that at the end of the day, Hideki Anno is a fine director. His last movie, Shin Godzilla, was really good. He should have been working on original projects instead of this. At the end of the day, even though there's positive aspects to the whole thing, I feel like this was territory that was covered, you know? And more than that, this was a show that was deeply personal to its creator and the specific mind state there in 25 years ago. Going back now that he is in a different place in his life, feeling, you know, detached from all of that is a fool's endeavor, I think. I really don't understand what the point of this was now that it's all said and done, except for we can go back and add CG, George Lucas style, and we can make some money. The Star Wars prequels comparison is appropriate. What I would recommend instead of this is that Amazon Prime put up a documentary in two parts that goes for nearly 2 hours on Hideki Anno and the making of this film, going into his depression and his struggles to just get it over the line and his clear lack of inspiration, which explains a lot about this film and is also much more interesting. So if you look up Evangelion on Prime, you know, I won't tell you not to watch this film, but I will tell you, watch the Hideki Anno documentary. Really interesting. Anyway, that's the movie.
And that's Film Fight Club. So we'll be back next week talking Val and he's all that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe
Lab Diaz, right? Yeah. He is all that.
Yeah. In the meantime, someone can explain to us how TikTok works, because I get it, but I don't get it. Well, I might have to get TikTok for this episode.
Oh, yeah, Addison Rae.
We have to radically condense our
episode. She's a TikTok star.
1 minute. We have to radically condense our episode to a 1 minute diatribe and not an hour.
How do we condense things to nuanced commentary to 1 minute blocks? Like, how do we?
You play some background music, you start dancing, and you point at things, then text comes up, and that's it.
Like, I actually am curious. I don't know about the extent. I mean, obviously, like social forums like Twitter, to some extent, Instagram, obviously Facebook, there is quite an active film critic community. I'm wondering to what extent that is active on TikTok. I don't know. I don't have TikTok.
Look, Twitter is great, mainly because I've only exclusively dated people from Twitter. That's all. So I have conflated my social media.
I think there probably is a film community on TikTok because everything's on TikTok, but it just goes into the broader thing. And maybe I'm being a cynic here. Do the TikTok generation actually care that much about movies?
Yeah.
What are they?
Well, if they're not Marvel, they probably don't.
There was an amazing story about all the famous directors' kids who had adopted TikTok and used to put their parents in it. I think Del Toro's daughter is actually quite popular on TikTok.
Yeah, right. There's and Scorsese as well.
That's pretty great.
You know, Del Toro's
amazing editing on some of the TikTok videos I've seen gone viral. The transitions are amazing.
I was going to say, you know, Del Toro would have been an interesting person to make his version of La Seville because his parents were famously kidnapped by the cartels.
Right.
And James Cameron paid the ransom. This was in the 90s.
What a legend.
I know, yeah, what a legend.
James Cameron, he's making 5 Avatar films now?
Yeah, he's deep in post-production on Avatar 2 and 3 at the moment. 4 and 5, I think, are at a break in production. I think they've entered production, but won't be finished until we see how the box office for Avatar 2 goes.
I could just imagine James Cameron having like this editing suite in this subterranean water-filled cave lair,
yeah,
where he's cut off and there's like several feet of metal between him and anything that and any outside pressure. And he's just sitting there editing with all these reels.
Mm-hmm.
Like you just know that's exactly what he's doing. And he comes up for air like every 3 months to just see, okay, COVID's still here. Great, going back down.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure he's happy to be in New Zealand right now if he is there. I'm not sure if he's come back to Los Angeles, but I imagine he's probably still in New Zealand. But I'm keen for the Avatar sequels.
I'm keen. Like the production, I didn't like the story, but it's Fern Gully, but the production design was incredible.
That's it. And you always know that James Cameron's going to direct well. He's going to deliver a visually impressive action film with the old school way. Avatar delivered in spades in the action. It was just everything else I was disappointed about.
Unobtainium. Yeah. Jake Sully. If Australian. Again, I'm fine with those seeing Australians. I just wish they were in better form. Australian accents were accompanied by better performances.
Yeah.
Speaking of Australian accents, Kyle MacLachlan is in Sydney doing Hotel Quarantine. And he's doing a bunch of hilarious updates where he's trying to learn Australian via Twitter updates. It's quite funny. It's nice seeing him here. It's very wholesome.
But looking at his Twitter feed, I couldn't help but think that he's now stuck playing his character from Twin Peaks, where it's all very like, gee whiz, wow, did you know the world is so wonderful type persona? The like very forthright, like authoritative delivery of positivity. Anyway. But no, Kyle MacLachlan's a legend. I'm glad we have him here.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing him. Like if I can see Murray Bartlett running around from White Lotus, I'd like to see Kyle MacLachlan just like down the street one day. Like, hey dude, hey Carl, how you doing, mate?
Stay away from me. I'm following COVID protocols.
Oh no, No. I'd recognize him any day.
Yeah.
Yes, you'd be in a mask. Oh dear. Well, yes, we'll be back with Val Kilmer documentary, which looks great, and the buzz has been really, really strong. And I like that it's been narrated by his son.
Yeah, right. Interesting.
And he's all that, which just, God, it can't come soon enough.
TikTok, we love you.
Yeah, whatever you are.
Yeah.
Good night.
Gen Z, we love you. Bye.